Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the organizer of a national and international protest that will take place on Saturday, April the 15th, otherwise known as Tax Day. Jennifer Taub, a law professor at Vermont Law School, whose research focuses on corruption, corporate political spending, and the links between money and politics, joins us to discuss how she was inspired by Kellyanne Conway's dismissive remark that voters don't care whether Trump releases his tax returns. She, along with some comedians and the creator of House of Cards, have created a movement that has stimulated 130 national and global events in a tax march, taking place on Saturday, to point out that while ordinary folks have to pay taxes, Trump does not even feel he owes voters the transparency of whether or not he pays taxes. Meanwhile, Trump and the Republicans are preparing what they refer to as tax reform that will give even more tax breaks to the rich and begin the dismantling of Social Security. Then we'll speak with Stephen Pfeiffer, the director of the Brookings Institution's Arms Control Initiative. He served on the National Security Council as senior director for Russia, Ukraine, and Eurasia, and joins us to discuss today's meeting in Moscow between Secretary of State Tillerson and Vladimir Putin. We will discuss the wild swings in U.S. foreign policy of late and speculate whether Putin regrets helping elect Trump now that his former friend finds it beneficial to distract the public from the Russia investigation by bombing Putin's Syrian ally, Assad. Then finally, George Lakoff joins us in the studio. He is a professor of cognitive science and linguistics at the University of California, Berkeley, and author of The All-New Don't Think of an Elephant. We will discuss what strategies of resistance are forming in response to the Trump administration in the absence of any strategy coming from the Democratic Party, and look into ways in which progressives can engage conservatives who support Trump, even though he has no empathy for them or the issues they care about. And joining us now is Jennifer Taub, who's a professor at the Vermont Law School. Previously, she coordinated the business law program at the Eisenberg School of Management at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, and was also associate general counsel for Fidelity Investments and assistant vice president for the Fidelity Fixed Income Funds. She's the author of Other People's Houses, and her latest book is Corporate and White Collar Crime. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jennifer Taub.
Thank you. It's great to be here, Ian.
Well, thank you, Jennifer, and I'm very proud of what you're doing. You went to the Women's March on the day after Donald Trump's inauguration in Boston, and then you were looking at television the next day, and Kellyanne Conway pops up and says that Donald Trump is not going to release his tax returns and that voters don't care. And that kind of got under your skin, and then you just started tweeting out, "Show us your taxes," protest for Saturday, April the 15th, which is tax day coming up. And from your lips to what, 150 organized protests around the country and the world about to happen on Saturday?
So it's kind of amazing. Yeah, there are about 100, there's more than 150 rallies and marches planned across the country and abroad, all the way from Anchorage, Alaska, down to the March-a-Lago, which is being held in Palm Beach, Florida.
So tell me about how this proceeded from your just getting ticked off by Kellyanne Conway on television to Saturday's protest that is growing by the day, and it's going to be very colorful. There'll be people dressed in chicken suits, the refrain being Donald Trump is too chicken to show us his tax returns. The Democrats, of course, in Congress have been, you know, stepping up and filing bills along the lines of forcing Trump to release his tax returns in the way that the Republicans kept voting on getting rid of Obamacare. So they're, to some extent, keeping their feet on the fire. So walk us through how this grew into Saturday's massive protests around the country and around the world.
Sure. I mean, our centerpiece march is going to be in Washington, D.C., and there are numerous marches in California, including one in right there in Los Angeles, and the leader, one of the main organizers of that march is Delia Brown. But it grew into this massive movement quite literally overnight. it started out with a tweet of mine that you mentioned, and also a comedian named Frank Lesser, who used to write for the Colbert Report. We didn't know each other until we both, were thinking alike. I was very frustrated that Kellyanne Conway, who is an aide to Donald Trump, said that he was never going to release his taxes and that people didn't care. And, you know, I knew people cared. I'd seen the petition on the White House website that people were signing in droves, and I knew that I cared. And I just thought I would express that. I was feeling very hopeful. As you mentioned, I'd gone to the Women's March. I'd gone to the rally and march in Boston. And it just was an idea that we should have a march on April 15th, which I knew was a Saturday. In my wildest dreams, I did not actually think that I would be involved in transforming that idea into a march. But when I say that happened overnight, what I mean is I sent out, I put out these tweets around 2 in the afternoon. Frank's came at around 4. And because he's connected in the entertainment industry, lots of people he knew were retweeting it. And then the next thing I knew, the next morning, on Monday morning, I wake up and see there's this article in the Huffington Post that featured both of our tweets and said, hey, this should be the next big protest after the Women's March. And then people saw that article, I guess, and saw the tweets and started contacting me saying, hey, how can I help you get this going? And I kind of laughed to myself, thinking, what do you mean, help me? I'm not doing anything. I'm just tweeting. And it turns out, I got in touch with Frank, thinking maybe he would have some ideas. And by that time, by Monday, some folks had already started planning their, these satellite marches. And I connected with them, and then we, within days, had formed an executive committee and began setting up a website that could be an umbrella site. And just figuring this thing out, and what the metaphor I love, one of my colleagues running the Philadelphia March and on the executive committee, Gwen Schneider, says, we were building a plane in midair, and it sure feels like that.
So you got Frank Lesser, the comedian, on board, and then Patton Oswalt and Billy Eichner, and along with and Bo Willimon, of course, the creator of the Netflix TV series House of Cards, and how do you shame the shameless? Because I don't think Donald Trump gives a damn about anybody but himself and his family and making money. And I don't know how you get to him, because he really, he was trained by Roy Cohen to be just ruthless and in your face and take no prisoners. But it is pretty outrageous that he doesn't show us the decency and courtesy to reveal his taxes as previous presidents have. But it's particularly galling that this is happening at a time when the Republicans are preparing what they call tax reform, which will involve massive tax cuts for the extraordinarily wealthy, Donald Trump's cronies and backers, along with something that's really mendacious, which the Associated Press are reporting, that the Republicans are toying with the idea of eliminating the payroll tax, which funds Social Security and parts of Medicare. And this has been described by Social Security advocate Nancy Altman as a Trojan horse that appears to be a gift in the form of middle-class tax relief, but would, if enacted, lead to the destruction of working Americans' fundamental economic security in Social Security. So there's an awful lot at stake here.
You're absolutely right, and I'm glad you mentioned those themes, because this march is about so much more than just asking the president to release his taxes, just like every president has done since Watergate. It's bigger than that. We care about tax policy. And by that, I mean what you've touched upon, which is that we need everybody to pay their fair share, but also how we use those tax dollars. How can we use this public resource to fund the services, the activities, the communities to help us all thrive, not just survive in this country? How do we create a society of shared prosperity when we are an incredible country with tremendous resources, and those resources and opportunities need to be spread fairly?
So is there a way, do you think? I mean, my sense is that protest and resistance is happening almost in spite of the Democratic Party. they are the opposition party, but they're not offering any strategies of resistance. And the day after the inauguration, there was a spontaneous manifestation of millions of women around the world, and that you were at the Boston March, and that helped get you moving in this direction too. So it's happening, but at the same time, I believe something like 85 to 90% of Republicans are just absolutely thrilled with Donald Trump and what he's doing. So how do you reach those people? Because he's taking them for a ride. He doesn't give a damn about them. He has no empathy as a human being, and he doesn't care about these people, but they don't know that yet. And they're going to have to learn the hard way. And unfortunately, all of us will be collateral damage in that learning process.
You know, I have some optimistic thoughts on this. I guess a couple of things. I wanted to say one thing directly to talk about the Republicans, and then also some things about the Democratic Party leaders. So, you know, yesterday's special election in Kansas was a real warning sign. That was pretty close. The Democratic challenger in a Republican district got very, very close to potentially winning. And that should make, I think, all congressional Republicans very, very nervous about their prospects in 2018. What I want to say about the Democratic leaders is I'm so thrilled that we have three members of Congress speaking at our march in D.C. Senator Ron Wyden, who has been a leading voice on trying to get Trump to release his tax returns and also on tax fairness for years. We also have Representative Maxine Waters and Representative Jamie Raskin. As you know, Maxine Waters is just incredible. She's very popular now, especially with the millennials, because she really speaks truth, cuts right through it. And I am, you know, she to me is, you know, a rock star. Cannot wait to hear her speak there. Also, Jamie Raskin is a freshman Democrat in from Maryland, and so excited to hear his voice as well. So what I am seeing is power is a challenging thing. When you have one party, in this case the Republican Party, with all three branches of government, the minority party is in a tough position. So what's interesting here is that, as you know, Democrats made up the majority of voters. You know, Hillary Clinton in the presidential campaign won the popular vote by more than 3 million votes. And where that matters is it matters on the telephone, it matters in the protests, and it's going to matter. It's going to matter in 2018 as well. And so what I think is happening is we're seeing this fourth branch of government, we the people, civic leaders stepping forward in every community saying, we got this, and we do, and this is just the beginning.
So, but what about how do you reach Trump's people? Because even though Trump has no empathy for them, Hillary Clinton certainly didn't show any empathy towards these people. She called them deplorable, and I don't think that's helpful. And I think they're being had, but, you know, as I mentioned, we're also collateral damage in the learning curve that's necessary for people to find out that they've been had. You know, if you buy a lemon, you don't like admitting that you've been had. So it's not an easy process, and I'm wondering if there's any way to accelerate that process.
You know, I guess I have two thoughts on that. First of all, I do have friends and family members who are Republicans, and privately, they tell me how disappointed they are in this president and, frankly, embarrassed by him. Doesn't mean that they're going to say that publicly. In terms of the economic disenfranchisement issues, those are strong and those are real. And I think what's critical is, although I'm participating in something that where I'm asking, you know, the president to do something that he doesn't want to do, we need much more, obviously, in the progressive, in terms of the progressive policies than to be against something. And I think we're definitely for something. And I think the first piece of it, when I think about a progressive agenda, the first is shared prosperity. And everything that we need to do that, which is a living wage for all. I think the second piece of a progressive agenda is having affordable health care. And I think that needs to be through Medicare for all, for example. The third piece of a progressive agenda would be affordable higher education. And by that, it should be debt-free. I think the fourth piece of a progressive agenda would be true equality and dignity for all, and that is especially especially when it comes to communities of color and interactions with law enforcement. And I think the final piece for a progressive agenda would be having a safe, sustainable planet. And I think those five pieces are really what so many of us care about. And part of what we're doing now is saying, you know, what do we want and how do we create that? And I think TaxMarch is part of that.
Well, just in the last minute then, Jennifer Taub, do you think that there's a way to get Trump to at least acknowledge that this issue has not gone away, his taxes?
We will see. I have not yet seen a tweet from him, but I'll let you know if I do.
Well, he watches television, right? And you're going to have a lot of things for him to see.
There will be lots of cameras at the D.C. event, so perhaps he'll tune in. Or I understand that he might be down at his resort in Mar-a-Lago, so maybe he'll, you know, take a look out the window and see the protesters.
Well, Jennifer Taub, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks so much, Ian. Great to be here.
And again, I've been speaking with Jennifer Taub, who's a professor at the Vermont Law School. Previously, she coordinated the business law program in the Eisenberg School of Management at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, and was also associate general counsel for Fidelity Investments and assistant vice president for the Fidelity Fixed Income Funds. She's the author of Other People's Houses, and her latest book is Corporate and White Collar Crime. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the meeting today between Secretary of State Tillerson and Vladimir Putin and the wild swings in U.S. foreign policy of late.
Outside the Paishan millions, put them into power. Expect a little more back for their taxes. Like school books, beds in hospitals, and peace in our bloody time. All they get is old men grinding.
From Russia with love, I fly to you, much wiser since my goodbye to you.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Stephen Pfeiffer, who is the director of the Brookings Institution's Arms Control Initiative, where he focuses on arms control, Ukraine, and Russia issues. He served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of European and Eurasian Affairs, U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, and Special Assistant to the President and Senior Director for Russia, Ukraine, and Eurasia on the National Security Council. In addition to Kiev, he had postings in London, Moscow, Geneva, and Warsaw, as well as on the National Security Council. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Pfeiffer.
Thank you for having me.
And you're just back from a trip to Ukraine, and today Secretary of State Rex Tillerson met with President Vladimir Putin for nearly 2 hours. He also met with Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. And this seemed to have happened at the last minute. So Lavrov seems to have given him a sort of bill of particulars, largely complaints. What do you think happened in the 2 hours? Because Tillerson at least has previous meetings with Putin, who awarded him the highest medal, the Medal of Friendship. So presumably there was at least an opening there for some kind of rapprochement.
Yeah, no, first of all, the meeting with Putin, I don't think was in doubt. This is a little game the Kremlin plays about holding the meeting to the last minute, but it was pretty clear that President Putin was going to meet with Secretary Tillerson. By the accounts that have come out, and there was a brief press briefing following the Putin meeting, it looks like the meeting went about expected in that the sides had some conversations about some very difficult issues, Syria, Ukraine. While it doesn't appear a lot of progress was made, it looks like they're now opened up the communication channels. They've talked about, for example, establishing some working groups to try to get together on some of the problematic issues. So a process has begun.
But it seems, though, that we have, in terms of sort of adult supervision in the White House, you do have General McMaster, who comes out of the military. You have Tillerson at State Department, who's a businessman, not a diplomat. And there's been some questions about how much influence he has, where Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law, seems to have almost every portfolio imaginable. Do you see a vacuum in diplomacy?
I'm not trying to say a vacuum. I think people are still waiting to see exactly what the foreign policy process is going to be. You have, at the White House, General McMaster, who is assembling a very professional National Security Council staff. But it's also the question is, how does the NSC staff relate to the president's son-in-law, and how do they relate to the strategy group under Steve Bannon? And it comes down to the question, if there's a crisis, who does the president call first? Who does he look to provide advice on his talking points? I'm very much hoping that General McMaster takes that role, because that then puts in place a process where you get the White House, the State Department, the Defense Department, all on the same page. And I think we've seen in the last 4 days, well, I'm not an expert on Syria, there's been a little bit of confusion here, because if you go back to last Friday, it was very clear then in U.S. public statements that the cruise missile attacks were related to retaliation to the use of chemical weapons by the Syrian government. But since then, you had the president's spokesman on Monday say, well, it was a question of further chemical weapons attacks or barrel bombs, and then the Secretary Tillerson saying, you know, perhaps it's suggesting perhaps it's now about regime change in Syria. And we need to have, you know, clarity as to what the U.S. policy is. And my guess is that was a question that was put to the Secretary when he was in Moscow.
So what then is, it looks as if General McMaster at least is getting through to President Trump in terms of the intelligence. I imagine, you know, even though Stephen Bannon seems to still have some influence there, he's no longer on the National Security Council, and I'm not sure whether McMaster still has to go through Bannon to get into the White House and get into the Oval Office. But nevertheless, it does appear to me that Donald Trump has been influenced by the intelligence, which apparently they've been delivering, suggesting that there's Russian complicity in the Syrian sarin attack.
Well, the Defense Department said that there is compelling evidence that it believes that, in fact, the chemical weapons attack was conducted, you know, by a Syrian Air Force plane. I think they're still trying to pin down exactly whether the Russians knew and how complicit they might have been in this specific attack. But, you know, the Russians have had a significant military presence in Syria for quite some time, and it would be surprisingly incompetent of the Russians not to know about things like this.
Well, that's the word, of course. Incompetent is the word that Tillerson used, and the idea being that, you know, he's going to put pressure on Putin to either, you know, acknowledge that some complicity or at least, you know, try and rein in Assad. But the one thing that Tillerson said that he was going to try and do, which I thought was pretty impossible, surely, and that is to drive a wedge between Assad and Putin. Isn't Assad a hero to the Russian people? The Russian media propaganda machine controlled by Putin has painted him as a hero, have they not?
Well, it's certainly true that the Russian government has chosen to back Assad, and for a couple of reasons. One is there's a concern in Moscow that if Assad were to fall, would Syria be plunged either into further chaos than it is now? And also, if you're sitting in Moscow and you're talking about Russian great power, you don't have very many allies. And so there's a reluctance there to cast aside an ally like Assad, even though he's committed, you know, absolutely despicable acts against his own people. It would have been, I think, an overreach for the secretary to try to push President Putin to disassociate Russia from Assad, but certainly it would have been entirely appropriate to tell the Russians, you have to rein this guy in. There are certain things like use of chemical weapons against his own people that are simply not acceptable.
But in terms of the reconstruction of Syria, which I believe is a subtext in much of what these discussions are about, because there was a conference in Brussels at the time of the Syrian gas attack, and the EU foreign minister was, I think she got about $8 billion in pledges, and it absolutely mystifies me why anybody in the West would want to bail Assad out. Why not throw that in Putin and the Iranians' lap And so is that a useful strategy on the part of Tillerson and Trump?
Well, my guess is a lot of the interest in Europe in trying to have some kind of a plan to rehabilitate Syria, of course, is to relieve some of the pressure from all of the refugees that are coming out of Syria in towards Europe. But any talk of that kind of reconstruction plan or rehabilitation, you know, that's way in the future until you could actually get some kind of a settlement on the ground. And with the various warring factions within Syria, that's very difficult to see.
So do you have a handle on Ambassador Pfeiffer, on what's going on? Because this foreign policy of Donald Trump, particularly vis-a-vis Russia and Syria, has just turned on its head and zigzags all over the place. Do you have a handle on any kind of coherence here?
Well, again, we're sitting here trying to figure it out, and I guess there are people in Moscow also trying to figure it out. What it seems to me is if I am more comfortable about where American policy towards Russia is now than I was, say, in December. And that's in part because you've seen what the Vice President has said, the Secretary of State has said, the Secretary of Defense has said, and then General McMaster's. I mean, they're all basically talking about a pretty conventional Republican approach to dealing with Russia, which is a wary skepticism. I'm not sure that the President, by instinct, is there. And so, you know, I still want to watch and see how his views evolve. But you know, if you look at where we are with Russia today, the idea that I think that the President may have brought into the White House, and then his first National Security Advisor, General Flynn, may have had, this notion of some kind of a grand bargain with Russia, which is always difficult to see. You know, it appears now that maybe the White House recognizes that that kind of grand bargain isn't there, and that they're going to have to deal, on the difficult issues on their own merits, and what's going to be probably a pretty difficult slog if we want to get back to a better place with Russia. And it's going to require that Russia correct some of its egregious misbehavior.
But in terms of just plain lying, and after all, we have a president who has a pretty loose relationship with the truth, but Putin's, you know, was trained by the KGB. And, you know, I recall, for example, the Soviet Union had this massive secret biological warfare program, which they had signed an agreement to get rid of under President Nixon, and they'd secretly kept this massive program going, and it may well still be going to this day. I got to know this character, Ken Alabak, who was the deputy director of Biopreparat, the secret entity that was making all of these not chemical weapons, but bacteriological weapons, which would essentially inflicted the plague and smallpox on the planet. It's just absolutely horrible stuff, and even more horrible if it can be stated than chemical weapons. So I don't have a lot of faith that Putin tells the truth, but do you think he does in private in these negotiations?
Well, there are clear instances, and you can point to a number of them where Vladimir Putin has flat out lied publicly. Go back to, I think it was March 3rd or March 4th of 2014, when he said the little green men that were busily taking over Crimea were not Russian soldiers. And then 5 weeks later, he said, oh, yeah, they were Russian soldiers. But, you know, when you're sitting down with the Secretary of State, you have to calculate, because, you know, if you tell too many lies and you lose credibility, it removes the basis for a conversation. And my guess is Vladimir Putin understands that. So I would not guess that he's always truthful, but he recognizes that, you know, simply telling a string of lies to the Secretary of State is not going to get the relationship to where he wants it. And I think the Russians would like to see if there's a chance to improve the relationship with Washington. And they certainly like, and Vladimir Putin likes, the idea that Washington is engaging with him, because that plays to the Kremlin's self-image of Russia as a great power.
Well, just in closing then, clearly this cruise missile attack on Syria, which was militarily fairly insignificant but politically obviously very significant, has really turned things around for Donald Trump in the polls. He was sinking, and the Russian investigation was looming over him. And a lot of cynics, they may well be right, have suggested that there's a kind of wag the dog quality to this. But in general, if Putin did help elect Trump, which our intelligence services say is the case, Do you think Putin's sort of regretting it now? Because I think Trump has discovered that he maybe may get more political capital out of distancing himself from Moscow and taking them on over Syria than he has from whatever secret arrangements were made.
Yeah. I don't know that we can say Mr. Putin regrets it, but I'm pretty sure that in the Kremlin, they are very disappointed with where U.S.-Russia relations are 3 months into President Trump's term. My guess is that in November, in the immediate aftermath of the election, looking at the things that candidate Trump had said on the campaign trail, they had some expectations which they probably recognize now are not going to be met.
Well, Ambassador Stephen Pfeiffer, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Stephen Pfeiffer, who is the director of the Brookings Institution's Arms Control Initiative, where he focuses on arms control, Ukraine, and Russia. He served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of European and Eurasian Affairs, U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, and Special Assistant to the President and Senior Director for Russia, Ukraine, and Eurasia on the National Security Council. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back joined in the studio by George Lakoff, who'll be discussing what strategies of resistance are forming in response to the Trump administration in the absence of any strategy coming from the Democratic Party. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now in the studio is George Lakoff, a professor of cognitive science and linguistics at the University of California at Berkeley. He's the author of The Little Blue Book, The Essential Guide to Thinking and Talking Democratic, co-authored with Elizabeth Whaling. And his latest book is the all-new Don't Think of an Elephant, Know Your Values and Frame the Debate. Welcome to Background Briefing, George Lakoff.
A pleasure to be here, Ian.
It's good to see you again, George. And now we have, in Moscow, we have Vladimir Putin meeting with the Secretary of State, Tillerson. He's basically a businessman. And the only adult that seems to be running the Trump administration is General McMaster. So you have a general, you have a businessman, but you don't have a diplomat. But let's discuss these two leaders and what influences them. My understanding is that Trump, more than anything, was influenced by Roy Cohn, the famous witch hunter from the McCarthy era. And I also understand that Putin is influenced by Vyacheslav Surkov, this sort of eminence grise character that came out of the theater and has now become his political strategist. So if that's the case, what kind of alignment is that? What kind of standoff is that?
Well, first of all, I don't know if it's a standoff or if it's a way to cooperate. Right now, Putin is just getting whatever he wants from the U.S. and overriding all previous U.S. policies in Ukraine and and all over Europe and so on. So he's doing that. Tillerson, of course, is from ExxonMobil, and Tillerson negotiated with Putin for ExxonMobil to help them do oil and gas extraction as global warming warmed up the Arctic Ocean. So, they have an interest in that together. McMaster is an interesting person because in his book on the Vietnam War, he never mentioned the 3 million people who died, never mentioned Agent Orange, never mentioned the My Lai massacre, never mentioned anything that had to do with people being hurt. It was all about just strategy independent of people being hurt. So you have people running this thing who don't have any empathy, who are not there for empathy for the Earth, for the planet at all, and for what that means, or for empathy of people in war. That goes along with Trump, who seems not to have much empathy. So, I mean, he had to have his daughter tell him, oh, you know, it's bad to have children dying of sarin poisoning. So.
Right, and he proudly has tweeted out that he began the bombing of Syria and told the Chinese leader over a beautiful piece of chocolate cake.
Yes, right. And not only that, his bombing was pointless. I mean, it wasn't really, you know, he said, oh, I'm going to go get them, and so I'm going to bomb their airbase, and he barely destroyed anything there. And, a day later, day and a half later, they flew planes right out of that airbase and bombed the same city.
But in terms of what Surkoff has brought to the table in this kind of shape-shifting that goes on, where Putin funds pro and con groups, and I think Bannon has also learned something from Surkoff, where they send out mixed signals, they keep everybody off balance, that chaos may well be a part of the plan, although I think incompetence is probably a more accurate description. What do you make of that?
Well, first of all, Trump is very clear. He says, I'm not going to tell people what I'm going to do, because if I do, then I lose authority. And, you know, that's right. I mean, he says, I'm going to hold power, and I'm going to make the decisions, and no one else is going to know. And so that wherever you are, you're going to be off balance, and you're going to be waiting for me to make my decision, and that gives me more power.
So, where does Roy Cohn come into that, do you think?
Well, Roy Cohn just was ruthless about this. Roy Cohn said, you win one and you destroy your opponents, as he did with McCarthy. Right. And you destroy your opponents by destroying their reputations, by destroying their incomes, by destroying them in any way you can.
So he took a leaf out of his book with Crooked Hillary, did he not, Donald Trump?
Well, the Crooked Hillary thing is more what he knows instantly, you know, about being a salesman and how to use your brain for his advantage. So he did two things there. One is preemptive framing, that is framing somebody else, and he set the frame of Hillary as crooked. And the second one is repetition. So the way this works in the brain is the following. Any idea you have, as expressed in a frame, is there in neural circuitry, like if someone is crooked. That's in neural circuitry. The more a neural circuit is activated, the stronger it gets, and if it gets strong enough, it becomes permanent. And as it gets stronger, it's more likely to be activated. As it's repeated, it gets stronger and stronger. The synapses get stronger. So when you repeat Crooked Hillary over and over, both of those take place. And what he does is get that idea into people's brains, period. I mean, you do that, and he uses that technique and various other techniques to do this. I have been writing about this. By the way, I'm starting a citizens' communication network, and anyone can, for all activists or activist groups, anyone can join. It's free. And if you just, right now we're using my Twitter feed, which is at George Lakoff, capital G, capital L, and my official Facebook page to send things out. And you can just go there and join and get whatever we have. We have lots and lots of materials there for anybody who wants framing advice on anything. Let me give you an example of framing advice. Trump said he wants to get rid of three-quarters of the regulations. The regulations are terrible and horrible, and they get in the way, and they're costly, and so on. When he says that, what is really going on is that is from the point of view of corporations. If you shift the frame to people, regulations are there to protect people. That's why they're there. And so if he said we're going to get rid of three-quarters of the protections of people, that would sound very different. Said, for every two protections there are now, if you have a new one, we're going to get rid of two old protections. You know, he wouldn't get away with that, right? People would be like, United Airlines, dragging that guy down the aisle. In fact, that is the truth once you shift the viewpoint. And so what we're trying to do is get people all over the country, whenever they're talking or talking to, if you're in Indivisible, for example, talking to anybody, people who are your representatives, you say, hey, this is really about protection. Anytime you say regulation, think protection, you're protecting me. And not only that, the protections being taken away right now would harm me and my family in the following ways. I'm your constituent, and you are supporting getting rid of all the protections for my family. And here are some of them that you're getting rid of, and you've already gotten rid of this one, which is endangering my children. I mean, you need to be able to say that and more. When they say that, companies create jobs. Rich people, cut their taxes, they'll create jobs. Well, nobody gives you a job just because they're nice. You know, they say, oh, we're going to be nice, we'll give you a job. No, they give you a job if you can create profit for them. So employees are profit creators. Once you call yourself a profit creator and you use those words, you say, hey, I deserve a fair share of the profits. I deserve to be treated with respect. I deserve to be treated well. I'm creating profit for you. You don't create jobs, without me creating profit. And, you should be talking about the profit creators out there. And the same thing with pensions. What is a pension? A pension is delayed payment for work already done. They say, well, we can't afford these generous pensions. What do you mean generous? I already did the work. You're stealing my money. Mm-hmm. And it's a simple shift of viewpoint. As soon as you shift the viewpoint, the truth comes out. And what I'm trying to do is have people tell the truth from the point of view of ordinary people who are affected by power, right. the power structure.
Right. Well, of course, there's a lot of libertarians in this Trump administration with the Koch brothers and the Mercers, et cetera, pulling the strings. And libertarians, of course, believe in liberty for corporations only,
yes,
not for people. And again, I'm joined in the studio by George Lakoff, a professor of cognitive science and linguistics at the University of California, Berkeley. He's the author of The Little Blue Book, The Essential Guide to Thinking and Talking Democratic, co-written with Elizabeth Whaling. And his latest book is the all-new Don't Think of an Elephant, Know Your Values and Frame the Debate. So let's talk about, there's obviously the resistance. The public is way ahead of the Democratic Party, and you've toiled in the vineyards for a long time trying to get the Democrats smart with, I'd say, mixed results, in the sense that the Republicans have always been better at framing and semantics, etc. But what I find extraordinary now is that the one thing the Democrats have always lacked is inspiration and activism. They don't show up in midterm elections. The Republicans get every last voter out. The Democrats don't. More often than not, they're not inspired, and that happened certainly with the Clinton campaign. But now we have this phenomenon of a groundswell starting on the very day after Trump's inauguration. And on Saturday, there'll be this massive demonstration framed around the idea that show us your taxes, Donald Trump, before we pay our taxes, which is, I think, a really brilliant, simple. So I'm very gratified that if the institutions can't help us out, then maybe we should help ourselves.
Right. And by the way, on the 17th, Monday, I'm going to be on Indivisible Berkeley, live streamed to all of the Indivisible chapters. Wow. So that'll be an interesting phenomenon.
And Indivisible, of course, is started by Ezra and
Ezra
Angel. A couple of young congressional staffers who've had an amazing impact.
Well, their Indivisible guide is brilliant. I mean, and what the only thing they lack is, some better framing, though it's pretty good in there. Mm-hmm. They do a good job on the whole. Now, the Democratic Party is about trying to lose as much as it can. Today, it put out a list of talking points, which are all of the form, I am not a crook. I wrote a book called Don't Think of an Elephant, which may, if you negate something. And by the way, anytime you negate an idea, you have to activate the idea in the other guy's brain in order to negate it. As you activate the idea, you make it stronger. Mm-hmm. So the Democratic Party put a list of things that Trump had done or said, and then said it's false because of this, it's false because of that, and went all the way down saying, like, I am not a crook, I am not a crook, I am not a crook. They haven't learned the most basic lesson of the book, Don't Think of an Elephant. Right. And that's lesson number one. The Leadership Institute in Virginia that trains conservatives, that's the first thing they say. Never use the other guy's terminology even to negate them.
Right.
And that's, they don't even know that. But the reason they don't know it is a very interesting reason. See, if you're a conservative and you go to college, there's a very good chance you're going to study business and business economics. And in that curriculum, you'll study marketing. And marketing professors study my field, cognitive science. They study how people really think. That's very important. They study that people think in terms of frames, metaphors, narratives, emotions, images, and so on. Now, that means that conservatives who do that have as second nature a way to sell their ideas, to market them. But when progressives go to college, they don't take those courses. And they don't take cognitive science or neuroscience or cognitive linguistics. What they do is they take political science, law, public policy, economic theory, and so on. Now, in those courses, I hate to say this about all the universities, because I've taught for 50 years in universities. They use a false theory of language and of thought. They use a theory of reason from Descartes in 1650. Descartes said, I think, therefore I am, all thought is conscious. Thought is 98% unconscious. Consciousness is the tip of the iceberg. Conscious thought is structured by unconscious thought. Then the assumption is thought works by logic. He was a mathematician, Descartes, and he said, when I think consciously, it's sort of like I'm doing a proof. Well, no, it doesn't really work like that. It's largely unconscious, and it works by frames, metaphors, images, emotions, and so on. Very, very different. That is normal thought. And so Democrats don't understand this. Democrats assume that people, ideas fit the world directly rather than going through the neural systems of their brains. And they don't. They go through your values and your neural systems. They don't understand that words have different values. A word like freedom means something totally different to a conservative than to a progressive.
Mm-hmm.
I have a book called Whose Freedom that goes through that in very great detail. And the point is that people don't understand that words don't just mean what they say. Words depend upon the worldview that you have, and people have opposite worldviews. And this is something the Democrats don't seem to get.
Well, now, has this problem with the Democrats being out in the wilderness and way behind the Republicans, and again, when I look at Tom Perez, I think, my God, what are they doing, you know? And they didn't even give any money to this guy that did a very good job in this election that just took place yesterday in Kansas, where he came close in a solidly Republican district. So it was activists like the Daily Kos that gave this candidate money. Do you think that the problems that you're talking about, have they been exacerbated by social media? Because again, Bannon and company captured social media. Hillary Clinton didn't even know about it, I don't think. She was doing advertising, talking about the deplorables and all this stuff, and spending all this money saying the same thing over and over again right up to the last day. Meanwhile, Bannon, through Cambridge Analytica, a company that he and the Mercers own, they did data mining on social media. They buffaloed Facebook into getting rid of its human curation of the news, which enabled them to flood fake news into the mix. They targeted, micro-targeted different communities. My sense is that we are entering an era now where people get their, three-quarters of people get their news from Facebook, largely from their friends.
Mm-hmm.
We don't even know what's real anymore. I mean, how can you have a society in which there's no consensus on what is true?
It's a very, very difficult issue. And Facebook really ought to be having a set of major investigative reporters checking their news feed. The idea that the news, their news just goes out randomly is not a good idea in terms of what people like. You know, it's a like, so it goes out. No, it shouldn't. That shouldn't happen. So, I mean, Facebook is irresponsible in terms of not doing something like that. And I think it wouldn't cost them that much given their money. The media stuff is interesting. What Trump managed to do was use the media. Even if the media was against him, he's still using it.
$5 billion worth of free media.
Free media. MSNBC, you know, is supposedly anti-Trump, and every day, every story is about Trump. They don't understand that going against Trump helps Trump. Right. You know, don't, you know, I am not a crook, you know. Don't think of an elephant. Don't think of Trump. You know, you'll think of Trump. That's what they're doing every single day. I was called by the show On the Media, very good show by Brooke Gladstone, and she asked me, what do you do to cover Trump? And I gave her the following answer, that anytime Trump says something, he's most likely trying to get control of the story with something that's not true and to divert it from some real issue. So what you need to do is keep on top of the real issues and start always the coverage with the truths about the real issue. That is, frame with truth first. Secondly, if he's trying to use some diversionary issue, frame with the truth about the diversionary issue first and point out that this is a diversion. Say, he's trying to divert your attention from this real issue with this other one. Here's the facts about this real issue. Then you say what Trump says in his tweet or whatever, and then you say, as you can see, this is false. You know, he's trying to divert you with false information. The real issue is this. Let's get back to the real issues.
But how do you deal with, I mean, progressives tend to talk to themselves. And the other side, the conservatives would rather be effective. They don't care about intellectual inconsistencies. Liberals and progressives tend to want to be righteous rather than effective. And we're dealing with a phenomenon where 85 to 90% of Republicans absolutely love Donald Trump. They are thrilled with him. He's doing a great job.
Right.
They're thrilled with this guy. He's just put on the Supreme Court. How do you reach those people? Bernie Sanders is the only person who's even thinking about reaching these people who Hillary Clinton demonized. I mean, there's obviously this cognitive dissonance between the fact that Trump's populist message, how can it possibly play with billionaires hanging out at Mar-a-Lago and rubbing shoulders with the Koch brothers and the world that he belongs to? And all this talk about draining the swamp, when look at the people he's put on the cabinet, the evidence is overwhelming, but how do you break that cocoon of denial about who this guy is? Not with the progressives who already have figured this out, but with the people who need to figure it out.
You also need to do it with progressives who aren't sure of themselves, who are partly conservative. The issue has to do with, again, a neural phenomenon, something about the brain. I'm finishing up a book on the neural mind right now with the co-author. And the basic idea is this. Most people are not all one or all the other, not all progressive or all conservative. What is a moderate? A moderate progressive is someone who has partly conservative views on different issues, so one issue or another. A moderate conservative has some progressive views, again, on different issues, but there's no such thing as a single set of values for a conservative, for a moderate. There is no ideology of the moderate. They're just variations on the other. And then the question is, well, how does it work? How can someone be a moderate? Well, you can be a moderate because in order to be, if you have, let's suppose you're a conservative and partly progressive, on the part where you're progressive, you have to have a progressive worldview, a moral worldview that's progressive, applied only to certain issues but not others. So you have to have one worldview applied to many issues, the other worldview applied to certain issues. Now, those worldviews are opposites of each other. How can you have opposite worldviews in the same brain? Any neuroscientist will give you the answer. Each worldview is characterized by a neural circuit, and all through the brain there are circuits called mutual inhibition. The activation of one turns off the other. And as one gets stronger, the other gets weaker. So that if you can strengthen their progressive worldview, then you weaken their conservative worldview. If conservatives, as they have over the past 20 years, can strengthen conservative worldview in people who are mostly progressive but partly conservative, the more they strengthen that, the more conservative the progressives get. So the idea is, how do you use language? you use language always to talk about in terms of your worldview. And you don't use it to negate the other guys. You never do that. You have to have positive language for your worldview. Now, there's another phenomenon you need to know about conservatives, arch-conservatives. People who are very, very conservative tend to have what's called in-group nurturance. That is, they care about their in-group. If they're in a church, they care about, you know, other church members who might happen to be poor but are good churchgoers and have good families and so on. And if they're losing their homes, they might even build them a house. You know, they care about people in their military units. They care about the people they go bowling with or in their neighborhoods. And if there's a flood, you'll see these conservatives out there swinging the sandbags. If it's a fire, they'll be on the fire hoses. Namely, they care about the people in their in-group, whatever that is. It could be their community, their friends, their neighbors, their church group, whatever. Now, when you talk to somebody who is very conservative, what you want to do is evoke that sense of in-group, because that is where progressive thought lives in them. They already have that progressive thought. And you're not going to activate it by talking policy. You're not going to activate it by using the usual, progressive policy language. What you need to do is talk at the level of people, at the level of their families, their homes, what really matters to them, whether they're going to be, their food is going to be safe to eat, their water is going to be safe to drink, is there going to be stuff in the water? Let me give you an example. How would you feel if you needed drugs, if you had diabetes or cancer or something, and you're prescribed a drug and it didn't work? And what would happen if 9 out of 10 drugs didn't work? Well, that is in fact what is likely to start happening now, given something that came out of the Trump administration, which said that you don't have to have drugs tested by the Food and Drug Administration, that the companies can do their own tests. Well, the Food and Drug Administration, I've talked to the former head of this, says, look, every drug is supposed to be safe and effective. Well, when you test for effectiveness, 9 out of 10 drugs fail. Most people don't know that in our tests. Mm-hmm. So we throw out 9 out of 10 drugs. If you don't throw them out, then right. They're out there. So yeah. If you are sick, chances are 10 to 1, sure. Your drug's not going to work. How do you feel about that? How do you feel about that idea? Wouldn't you like those drugs to work? Wouldn't you like the Food and Drug Administration to insist that drugs be effective? You know, does that matter to you? Right. You know, think about that for a minute. And, and then the question is, how would you deal with it? Do you have a Republican that you're voting for?
Right. Well, George, we've run out of time, and we need that message, and we need to win, and we're grateful for you. And I've been speaking with George Lakoff, Professor of Cognitive Science and Linguistics at the University of California, Berkeley. He's the author of The Little Blue Book, The Essential Guide to Thinking and Talking Democratic, co-authored with Elizabeth Whaling. And his latest book is The All-New Don't Think of an Elephant, Know Your Values and Frame the Debate. Thank you so much, George.
Always a pleasure, Ian.
This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.